Hi, welcome to the March 2009 Radiology Podcast. This is Herb Kressel, editor of Radiology. We are gratified by the many supportive comments that we have received on the podcasts we have developed this year. This month, we will discuss three papers appearing in the March 2009 issue of Radiology. First, we will speak with Dr. Rebecca Binman-Smith, who with her colleagues and members of the Breast Cancer Screening Consortium discuss a large study of over 10,000 examinations reviewing the positive predictive value of signs commonly employed in screening diagnostic mammography of breast cancer. This study is important as many of us were trained to employ a variety of signs without knowing their relative utility in different situations. The study sheds a new light on our approaches to diagnosis. Secondly, we'll be speaking with Dr. Amita Shukla-Dave from Sloan Kettering Memorial Cancer Center on an interesting study evaluating MRI and MR spectroscopic imaging in the determination of both clinically insignificant and clinically significant prostate cancer. As watchful waiting therapies for patients with prostate cancer are increasingly utilized, developing a better understanding of imaging findings and their relationship to clinical disease progression is important. Finally, we will be speaking with Dr. Richard Kujawski of the University of Wisconsin, who with his colleagues reported on a head-to-head comparison of 3T MRI and 1.5T MRI of the knee in the evaluation of hyaline cartilage. Head-to-head comparisons of 3 Tesla and 1.5 Tesla MRI are surprisingly unusual, and we're delighted to have the opportunity to speak with Dr. Kujawski on his interesting study. One of the exciting papers appearing in the March 2009 Radiology is entitled "The Positive Predictive Value of Specific Mammographic Findings by Reader and Patient Variables," authored by Aruna Venkatesan, Philip Chu, Carla Kirlikowski, Edward Sickles, and Rebecca Smith-Bindman. I am joined by Rebecca Smith-Bindman, who is Associate Professor, soon to be full professor of Radiology, Epidemiology, and Biostatistics at UCSF. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. I found this paper very, very interesting. Can you summarize what was done in the study?
The purpose of our study was to evaluate the risk of cancer, the positive predictive value associated with specific mammographic findings, masses, calcifications, architectural distortion, and asymmetries. What we did for the study is prospectively follow a large number of mammography examinations that had an abnormal result. We took those mammography examinations and linked them to a population-based cancer registry and then determine the risk of cancer of each of those findings, looking at it by patient characteristics, whether exams were screening or diagnostic. Overall, we had about 10,600 mammograms, and in those mammograms, about 1,500 cancers were diagnosed, and we looked at which findings were most predictive and least predictive of cancer.
How do you think that a reader should think about using the information you present? The findings that you're describing have, of course, been reported in the literature, and no doubt our readers will be familiar with them. But how do you envision one should use this data in daily clinical practice?
I think what's unique about our study is two things. First, it's very large size, and the fact that we collected these data from a lot of different readers. Overall, there were more than 40 different readers who read these mammograms. And because the size is so big, it really gives us a pretty definitive way to compare the value of these different findings. I think there have been previous studies, but mostly they've been very small, based at a single center, and so a little bit difficult for a clinician who's reading the paper to understand how the results relate to them. So I think our paper adds that. Also, methodologically, the way we've done the paper, by doing a cancer linkage, really gives us very accurate results. So I think a reader reading this paper should say, this is how I read mammograms. These are the things I look for. Where am I getting the most bang for my buck and telling me when I'm reading a mammogram which things are likely to prove to be real and significant for the patient and which are not? And then the reader can really focus on the things that are likely to be the most valuable.
So, Rebecca, where do readers get the biggest bang for the buck?
Well, I think the initial results are not surprising. When you see a mass on a mammogram, be it a screening or a diagnostic mammogram, that finding has the greatest prediction for cancer. That's where most cancer occurs, and most of the abnormalities are in that group. Calcifications are also very useful. Interestingly, we found calcifications are predictive of both invasive cancer and DCIS, and I was actually quite surprised about that, how much cancer that's invasive actually is associated with calcifications. So those two findings are the bread and butter of what we do as mammographers, and they're very predictive, so we should keep doing that. Architectural distortion, turns out people don't call it that often. It's a relatively uncommon finding, but it's reasonably predictive. So when you see architectural distortion, it really reflects cancer a lot. In contrast to these three other findings, asymmetries were much less predictive of cancer. So we see them a lot. We call them a lot. We note asymmetries on a large number of exams, but it turns out those exams don't tend to be the ones that are harboring cancer. Relatively little cancer occurs among those mammographs. Now, we then looked in greater detail at asymmetries, thinking, well, maybe some asymmetries are better than others, and we found, in fact, that developing asymmetry, something we usually see on a diagnostic exam, a new asymmetry, is more predictive of cancer as compared to sort of asymmetries that are either seen on only one view or are seen on a screening exam. Those are much less useful. They predict cancer, but very, very weakly, and much less so than the other findings I've mentioned.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much. I really think this data is of great interest and really will help practitioners understand the significance of the findings that they're reporting in the different populations. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks again. I really enjoyed it.
Hi, one of the articles that drew my particular attention in the March issue of Radiology is entitled Correlation of MR Imaging and MR Spectroscopic Imaging Findings with Ki-67, Phospho-AKT, and Androgen Receptor Expression in Prostate Cancer. This paper was authored by Dr. Amita Shukla-Dave and co-investigators at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and the Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center at Columbia University. Today we're joined by Dr. Shukla-Dave, who is first author of the paper and assistant attending physicist in the Department of Medical Physics and Radiology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cornell University Medical School. Hello, Dr. Shukla-Dave.
Hello, Dr. Kressel.
Your study was of 89 patients who underwent MR imaging and MR spectroscopic imaging prior to radical prostatectomy. The combined MR-MRSI findings in this group of 89 patients were correlated with known markers of degree of tumor aggressiveness, two proliferative markers, Ki-67 and phospho-AKT, as well as an androgen receptor. In addition, the MR findings were correlated with the results at surgical pathology, particularly with respect to the determination of clinically insignificant prostate cancer and clinically significant prostate cancer. My understanding is that in this study, the surgical path definition of clinically insignificant cancer was tumors with less than 0.5 cubic centimeters of volume and without any poorly differentiated elements. This is a really fascinating study. And the first question I'd like to ask you, Dr. Shukla-Dave, is why did you and your colleagues decide to undertake this study?
This was a study which was conceptualized by myself and our team leaders, Dr. Hedwig Riesek and Dr. Carlos Cardon-Cardo, who is a molecular pathologist of international repute. And the whole aim is the for the study is that we believe that we are at the beginning of a new era where imaging and pathologic examination can provide more information. So we think that this study will provide basic results for future prospective studies with large population in which these selected key markers can be evaluated in biopsy tissue, as they may provide pre-treatment quantitative data on the biological properties of the tumor.
So your results, of course, showed that the MR imaging and spectroscopic criteria combined correlated nicely with both the pathologic determination of clinically insignificant cancer as well as the proliferative markers you assessed. Can you tell us more about the criteria that were used to determine clinically insignificant prostate cancer on MR imaging and spectroscopy?
Sure. I will not go into the detail of each criteria as they are in the paper, but I would like to mention it that it was assessed on the whole prostate gland by using a 4-point scale, that is 0 to 3, and 0 meant definite clinically insignificant prostate cancer, while score 3 meant definitely significant prostate cancer.
With that regard, I know that you didn't analyze this directly, but do you have any sense on how frequently the spectroscopic data was affecting the final determination?
I would like to hear, as I mentioned, as I was telling the score, that this was the imaging was read by a very experienced reader with more than 10 years of experience in reading prostate imaging. So spectroscopy in our case was more of adding confidence and for giving data when it was not clear-cut on T2 and where spectroscopy really showed that there is no metabolic abnormality or there is a big cluster of suspicious voxels. So in these extreme cases is where spectroscopy helped imaging.
Do you have any thoughts on the use of some of the other parametric techniques that have been recently studied in MR imaging of the prostate, such as diffusion imaging or perfusion mapping? These might also provide more clear volumetric data.
Prostate cancer is, we know, multifocal. And we feel that additional sequences like spectroscopy, diffusion, or perfusion, depending on the centers and the availability of the sequences, a multi-parametric approach will be the way to answer many questions and will also help foreseeably in significant prostate cancer. At our institute, we are routinely using imaging, spectroscopic imaging, and diffusion-weighted imaging in prostate cancer patients. And on a selective cohort, we also do perfusion.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shukla-Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Kressel.
Although whole-body 3T MRI systems have been available for some time now, there have been surprisingly few head-to-head comparisons of the results of MR imaging at 3T versus 1.5T. In this issue, Kajowski and colleagues report their results in a study of 200 symptomatic patients who were evaluated for knee pain on either a 1.5T or a 3T MR system. The diagnostic performance of the MR systems for evaluation of knee cartilage was retrospectively assessed independently by 3 radiologists. The authors report that the 3T protocol they use resulted in higher specificity and accuracy than the 1.5T, but the sensitivity for lesion detection was equivalent at both field strengths. I am joined today by Dr. Richard Kajowski, first author of the paper. Dr. Kajowski is Associate Professor of Radiology at the University of Wisconsin at Madison and a member of the Musculoskeletal Imaging Section. Welcome, Dr. Kajowski.
Thank you.
Very, very interesting paper. We were excited to have a head-to-head comparison finally after all these years. And how do you think the results you reported have actually affected your practice? Do radiologists prefer one system or the other, or the referring clinicians?
Right. Usually when we make a decision about generalized evaluation of a patient with knee pain, we just routinely have them scan in whatever scanner is available, either 1.5T or 3T. However, after the results of our study suggesting improved diagnostic performance of a 3T system for evaluating patients with cartilage lesions, all patients who have an MRI examination with a clinical indication of assess the articular cartilage of the knee joint are now being routinely scheduled on the 3T scanner.
What about for other structures in the knee? Is there a difference between the two systems? Do you have any preferences?
There has not been a large number of studies comparing 1.5T and 3T for detecting joint pathology. One of my colleagues did do a retrospective study looking at the sensitivity of our group as a whole for detecting meniscal tears at 1.5T and 3T, and he did not find any statistically significantly difference in sensitivity or specificity between the two imaging systems.
You told me, though, that on a visual basis, the lesions appear easier seen.
Yes. What a lot of these studies don't take into consideration is how good the lesion looks. You could detect a lesion on both 1.5T and 3T, and they have equivalent sensitivity for detecting a lesion, but the lesion is so much nicer visualized because of the improved resolution, improved SNR of a 3T imaging system. So I don't think that our study took that into consideration of how nice these lesions looked.
Well, I think it may be reflective, though, in the higher specificity and accuracy that you obtained
right.
at the higher field strength.
Right, I agree with that.
Interesting. One of the questions that came up in the review of your manuscript was a concern about the 3T protocol not being fully optimized for 3T. And I wonder if you'd comment on if you think it affected the results and have you modified your protocol?
Right. One of our axial T2-weighted FASTBin echo sequence was originally used with a slightly longer repetition time of only 2,200 milliseconds. It's now known through much clinical experience that you should try to increase your repetition time at 3T in order to obtain similar T2-weighted tissue contrast. However, that lack of optimization was only on the axial images and would only affect evaluation of the articular cartilage of the patella. And fortunately, the articular cartilage of the patella is the most easiest surface of knee joint to assess. So I don't think it affected our results very much. However, we have subsequently modified our protocol to increase our repetition time on the axial weighted, T2-weighted.
Very good. Well, sequence. Dr. Kujawski, thank you so much for stopping by. And I'm sure the readers will find your paper of great interest.
Thank you.
This ends our March podcast. Thanks so much for listening. As always, we welcome your comments on the podcast and on other issues in the journal.